Thank you. Am I audible to everybody? Okay. My name is David Larrabee. As you said, I'm a professor of physics at Chicago University. I'm also a student at Union Theological Seminary. All but thesis at this point. And part of this work is sort of the end result of where some of my thesis work is going. The rest of it is a little more theological. These concerns come out of some experiences dating back to my freshman year in college when we were with a group that was doing lifestyle assessment. So we've been hearing a lot of Bible quotes, the same ones over and over, so I thought it was a new one that hadn't been put up yet. From Ezekiel, this is where Ezekiel is being handed the condemnation of Jerusalem, and it's done by example. This was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and the needy. And then in Leviticus 25, one that's probably a little more familiar to you, but in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of complete rest for the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Two competing demands. The earth, the poor. It's a subject that's been around for a long time about how we bind these two. If you're interested in a more theological reflection, I might recommend Leonardo Boff's The Quiet of the Earth, Cry of the Poor, Cry of the Earth. If there's any doubt that these concerns are just societal concerns, I'm not going to read it, but I give you Luke 16, 19 through 31, which talks about the rich man and the poor man. So that's going to be our starting framework. For the outline, I'm going to start with the basic argument. I'll talk a little bit about energy, poverty, and wealth. Talk about what it would mean to transition to a just and sustainable future. Talk a little bit about U.S. energy planning. And the social implications of that, and then on to personal responsibility and lifestyle assessment. There'll be lots of, we're engineers and scientists, we like data, so there'll be plenty of data. But I will, if you want the details of the data, there's an annotated version of this talk. I'd be happy to email you all the references and things like that. So I'm not going to take time with that. I'm starting with some assumptions. I'm starting that climate change is real, and the disciplines are working out the details. So I'm not arguing for that at all. Well, I'm not going to say anything about that other than that. I'm assuming we have a moral obligation to the poor and the marginalized, wherever they were on the globe. Part of the climate change message is that we must transition to a net zero carbon society, which means an ultimate elimination of fossil fuels. The key question is when, how long do we have, and how do we accomplish it? And rather than talk about all kinds of scenarios, and we'll talk a few scenarios, I'm going to take the attitude that the recent literature seems to suggest we've got about a trillion tons of cumulative carbon emissions. That maybe the details of the profile in the long range are not as important as simply the total amount of CO2. So the basic argument I'm going to give you is the following. Societies do require energy, but how much? We can answer that question by using something called the Human Development Index in the UN. It's a measure of sort of separating out energy wealth from energy poverty. Today's world producing energy creates CO2. And ultimately we need to shift to a net zero CO2 emissions world. Justice requires allowing less developed countries to develop. We'll talk about this a little bit later. This requires an increase in their energy use and their fossil fuel use. And without that development, global populations may certainly rise to unsustainable levels. Finally, allowing less developed countries to increase fossil fuel use requires developed countries to rapidly shift to a net zero CO2 emissions rate to limit us to a trillion tons of carbon. We can develop alternative energy sources. Heard a lot of talk about that. We can talk about CO2 sequestration, one of the words I have a hard time pronouncing. We haven't heard much about that. What we haven't heard very much about at all is a possibility of limiting our energy. And to the extent we can do that, that's immediate and almost free. So that's where we're going to head with this. So I'm going to ask, what changes do the United States need to make? And then finally, end with, why is this a Christian discipleship issue? I'm going to maintain that it is. So energy poverty and energy riches. Sermon on the Mount, feed the hungry, satisfy people's thirst, provide food, clothing, and shelter, medical care, travel to visit people in prison. All of these require energy. All of them. But how much? So I'm going to use the Human Development Indicator from the UN. It's been maintained by the UN for about 20 years. It looks at how societies allow the human beings in that society to develop individuals. So it measures life expectancy at birth, which is influenced by a whole host of factors. It measures education and a standard of living. Actually, it's a logarithm of the gross national income. And it's normalized to the maximum value of one. So here's an example of how it comes up. So Norway ends up leading the list, and I should back up and say, all the data is consistently, as Gunn was talking, 2010. And that took some doing. So Norway leads the list at 0.938. The United States is not far behind. But if I scan down the list, you can see that as you go down this, you get what we might consider traditionally less developed countries. Zimbabwe has, in 2010, was the bottom of the list. This is a somewhat famous curve. The HDI is from the United Nations 2010 report. Energy is ultimately from the Energy Information Agency's data for 2010. I've converted that to a unit called kilowatt hours per person per day. So I give this talk to kind of talk to theologians. I can relate that to the energy on their bill. Kilowatt hours, so very convenient. And you can see again, there's the outliers in the far right tend to be energy producing countries that burn off CO2 and things like that. You see where the United States is and where Canada is. You also see where Ireland and New Zealand are. That curve is a best fit. And given at the bottom is logarithmic, or put it the other way, that energy consumption seems to go like an exponential with respect to energy. This fit is better if you use electricity rather than total energy. But we're going to be talking about total energy. It's not that much. Well, I also mentioned that if you do the fit with the API taking out income, it also has the same kind of thing. A little bit different. So I put in here the green line. Represents the population-weighted average of HDI in the world. So when people talk about doubling the energy consumption, that would move that presumably up to that 120. The U.S. is 250. We're off the chart. So is Canada. You can see the curve takes a rapid nosedive to around this, say, 10,000 kilowatts per person per day. So we can actually use this to say that there's sort of a lower limit. We really do need some energy to provide the very basics of life. This is not surprising. Finally, for global plot. What I've done here is I've taken the CO2 emissions of the population in the world and sorted it by HDI. There's actually 168 countries in the sample that have data for both. It represents about 97% of the world's population. And so at any point on this, say come up to 0.6, that number represents the total CO2 emitted from that API and lower. And same thing for the population. So you might guess the first jump is India. And you can see that India and below, there's negligible contribution to the CO2 emissions in the world. The next big jump is China. And if you look at the jump at the end, it takes the blue dots, which are the CO2 emissions, above the population dots, that's the United States. So it's clear that the less developed countries, in some sense, are not responsible, they're not contributing much to global warming, climate change, simply because they're not the ones emitting the CO2. They don't have the income, they don't have the wealth to do that. Okay. Briefly, I'm going to go through a little model. Turns out other things correlate to CPI, like growth rates of populations. You want a population growth rate to go down, develop the country as CO2 emissions. So this is a very a physicist, right? So if I can't do it on the back of the calculation, don't believe it. So this is very crude, but I'm assuming that the population growth depends literally on API. And we can ask the question later, can that change? Can we do something different? The energy consumption depends upon HDI, like the graph we just said, but I'm going to adjust it so the numbers come out right, because Iceland needs more energy for heating, for instance, than like Mexico. So this is an adjustment. We're assuming the shape of the developmental curve is the same. CO2 produced divided by energy consumed is what we're concerned about. We'd like to get that to zero. So it's currently very, very slightly, but slightly development index. And I'm going to translate this to being API dependent, what I call an option for the poor. So that with less developed countries only have to reduce their CO2 emissions as they develop. You want to build a dam, you're going to take concrete, which emits CO2, and you're going to apply gasoline to run the truck. And I'm going to grow, when I talk about growing API, I'm going to grow it starting with the most emphasis on the poor. So we start off lowly, trying to get more growth rate, So this is what happens. Anthony knows how the details for all this. This is what happens when you take a look at current status, CO2 emissions, and leave everything else alone. The population runs up to about 20 million, well beyond the current cap. It won't happen that because of fermentation and things like that. Total energy goes up by 2, what people were projecting. CO2 actually kind of meets the target. This is in tons of CO2, when we talk about a trillion ton, that's carbon. There's a difference of about 3.67. So that's about the limit you have. The population average to the development index is plummeting. Why? Because it's looking at what's happening in the bottom. There's a big change. You can go 0.5, you can go up quite a bit. When you're at 0.9, you can't go up. So I say, okay, let's now grow the human development index of the country. It's been turned off there. And you see the population drops, it's still the problem. The total energy is more than 10 times. The CO2 is actually a little bit more, but not dramatically more. Why? Because as countries develop, we're assuming they're doing the abatement. And the population average API goes up very nicely. Yes, now, so you want to bring the population down, so now I shift, actually it's only about 9%. I shift up one of the, sort of parallel bring that curve down, and I meet a 9 billion target nicely. Energy goes up by a factor of 10, interesting issue, 2100. The CO2 production goes within our trillion ton, and the population average API also goes up nicely. So here's a scenario that works. Now, how do we do this? So this is a plot, this is US perspective, the Canadian, there's some plot for Canada about food with the stuff that's on the website. So if I take a look at US and Ireland as an example, if the US should be able to drop its energy consumption from 254 kilowatts per person per day to 110 without sacrificing API. You can't say that Ireland is somehow dramatically environmentally different than the average population. So what if we use, rather than the API curve, the one in the red line, all I've done is change the fit a little bit. Look at this. I get about the same population in the long term. I get an energy consumption that's much reduced. It's still a factor of 4. Okay? I get a CO2 emissions that are greatly reduced, okay, and the population average AGI increases. So I'm going to skip a couple of these. I'm going to start with on this side is our uses of energy in the U.S. 2010. On the middle side, is where it's coming from. And I'm going to plot up sort of optimistic projections of how we can replace them. So maximum wind power, hydro, nuclear, biofuels, and the most optimistic is solar, and you can see that there's a huge shortfall. And this is pretty much the most optimistic you get. That line is for Europe, and I'd hardly call a European lifestyle the free. One of the recent studies came out, and I sort of did it with capital version for theirs, which is a deep decarbonization study, and you'll see that they're even lower. So we don't mention the per capita numbers in the chart. So the question I have, what would it take to live the same quality of life with a reduction of over 50% of our average per capita energy? And can we realistically expect it to happen without personal lifestyle changes? And my answer to the last question is no. So I have some systematic lifestyle changes that are in this line. Okay, so let me skip over those because I think the answer to the question that really should ask is the following. We need to assess our lifestyle. And there is no generic one size fits all. I've recently moved from a rural setting into an urban setting, quite an interesting challenge. And so floor space, for instance, has gone down dramatically. So the locality that you're at makes a difference to what's possible. It depends on your income. Homeless people don't need to make an adjustment in their lifestyle to conserve CO2. And unfortunately, none of this data is given in sort of an economic strata form, which is to what. It depends on your job and your career. Some people have to travel more than others. And your ability to do that. So, back in the 70s, we had what's called lifestyle assessment groups. Last year we called them covenant groups. And it's more than just energy and carbon footprint. Issues of fair trade and slave trade. Fair trade and slave free items. Impact on the biosphere as a whole. Groups that provide a diversity of skills, provide accountability. And then put it in the context of discipleship. That group allows us to understand both the theological and biblical perspectives of these kind of lifestyle changes. I'll give you an example. This is an urban example, not a rural example. This is not a preserve. This is part of New York City. Jonathan runs what's called the New York City Urban Project. He has a program called We Log Off, locally organic, green, fair trade, slave free. He takes kids from the suburbs and plops them down into Chinatown. And then from there talks about relating the poverty to these overall issues. And it's seen in the context of being a disciple of Christ. So the role of the church. Well, I wish I could say I was successful in convincing a lot of pastors. I'm not. Including my own. Will we, the church, take up the challenge to facilitate these groups? Will we, the church, take on these issues seriously in our communal life? How does your sanctuary look? Will we understand our faith in disciples through the lens, the hermeneutical lens, the way we see things of eco-theology and biblical study together? And there's sort of four major categories of that we can talk about. You've heard mostly about Christian stewardship. There are other ways of looking at it. They all have strengths. They all have weaknesses. So, justice demands we facilitate the development of less developed countries. Really biblically, no way out of that. Nature demands that we lower our CO2 emissions. There's really no way out of that. This requires the developed world to trim their energy excess. This requires that many of us undergo lifestyle changes. Not all of us. And not all the same amount. not all the same way. The church can help develop the supporting group to facilitate these changes, place them within the context of Christian discipleship. We consider discipleship things like tithing, changing the church. Why can't we consider the general lifestyle of discipleship issue as well? Closing the picture of the organic farm in Mexico. And I'll close with Proverbs. Better a little with righteousness than large income with injustice.
So, for example, in the UK, we might say, hey, the Americans are burning it all, they should, you know, they should cut it, we don't need to. And also in China, now that they're actually aspiring for every person to have a car, and, you know, is there a kind of moral thing where, as you say, we should let them develop, but hang on, you know, can they really afford, can we really afford one per car? How do we get the kind of justice sort of, we'd have to kind of coordinate it, wouldn't we? Yeah.
Well, so the question, everyone hear the question? So the question is, we have issues now with China, with the other countries rising up and developing a lifestyle, or wanting to develop a lifestyle in the U.S., and their emissions rising. How do we coordinate that? So, you get an example in the UK. So, if I look at the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and sort of tag it by country of origin, U.S. is number one. Britain's number two. So if we stop thinking about how fast we're filling the glass with water, but how much water we've already put in the glass, China is in danger of putting more, but at the moment, they're not here one or two. And so the question of development, and I'll serve that I think you need to go through a fossil fuel phase to get to, if you take a windmill and you plop it down in the middle of Zimbabwe, no one knows how to make it. No one knows how to prepare it. What you're going to get in 5 years out is a really fancy lawn ornament. So what we need to do is develop the country so they know how to handle it and care for it, and it becomes an actual country.
So I've said that.
Nowhere in the scriptures do I find a method that we need to acquire more material goods. And so I think that a call to a perhaps, do you need to buy a new cell phone every time the latest one comes out? Cutting it in half just means doubling the time between purchases. And I see that very consistent with the gospel message of sort of anti-material.
But see, the question is if a cell phone, buying a cell phone every other year, energy drain, or is the technology behind the cell phone?
If I look at Europe and the U.S. in sort of comparison, it's not one thing. The houses are reduced in inside. The travel is reduced. It is a total lifestyle compression. And I said at the beginning, I don't think there's one cure. I think it's a matter of getting together with a fellow Christian, taking a look at your lifestyle, being responsible for each other, and saying, what can we do?
Issues of buying fair trade, reducing consumption, sharing your budget with people, and it's for use in small groups. And so I believe you can find that at bfjn.org.
Okay. In case you heard, give me your name, so it'll be on the tape. So listen to the tape, you can get the name. So the name is?
Boston Faith Justice Network, Lazarus.
I mean, just Megan.
Oh, my name is Megan Zonizer.
Megan Zoniner?
Zoniner.
Z-A-H-N-I-S-E-R. Email her, please.